name of one God, Holy Trinity. Amen. We're going to get there this morning, I promise, but we're going to have to take a circuitous route in order to do so. So I'm just warning you in advance. Hang in there with me, please. I suppose that we have all had just about enough of the bread of life. We're in our fifth week here, and we won't see that again until 3 years down the road. We have that final installment of this theme that John's Jesus picks up and has been driving for us. And there are some aspects of the teaching that are technical and relate to a particular point that John's community of followers are trying to put forward. In my mind, the points are non-essentials as they relate to early Christian Eucharistic practices. See, I told you we were going to have to take a circuitous route, right? Hang in there with me. But I should also say, in the interest of transparency, that I am not a particularly Catholic Episcopalian. As I see it, this piece of furniture that is behind me and to my left is a table rather than an altar. It's where we ritualize communion, where we remember the story with a focus on the dinner party and the so-called magic that happens around that table and all tables. And other points of view that are higher or more Catholic put forth this idea that it's an altar, and the sacrifice of the Mass that takes place there ritualizes and remembers the sacrifice that Christ makes in offering himself up. To me, those two distinguishing views are to some degree interesting in that sort of church nerd way. I've most certainly chosen one view over another, and yet if they are views that divide us, then I'd rather throw them out because neither the theology or ecclesiology of either of those particular views should be subordinate to Jesus' strong and central summary of the Christian life, which is to love God and to love neighbor or the other. As you already know, if you've been in this church week in and week out, in my humble but noisy and sometimes monotonous opinion, the point of this, the point of all of this, is always love. So I have little interest in giving more than a paragraph to high or low Eucharistic theology and ecclesiology. You can debate that for yourselves in Hanson Hall over decent coffee and marginal donuts after church. But this little rant that I'm opening up with doesn't mean I'm disinterested in the passage. I have a keen interest in this exchange that John's Jesus has with his disciples. It connects to the broader and deeper story of the past of the Hebrew scriptures, and I believe that it connects to our present future as well. So let's go back, way, way back there in Exodus. We remember the story of Exodus, Pharaoh, let my people go, and he doesn't do it, right? So God cooks up this scheme to get Israel out of slavery in Egypt. And even if you don't remember the story, you remember a little bit about it. They finally get out at the Passover. They're on their way to the desert, moving toward the Red Sea, and here comes the Egyptian army. It looks like the people of Israel are going to be slaughtered on the shores of the Red Sea by the pursuing Egyptian army. And then, no, Moses, with God's help, parts the sea. Israel moves across the sea. And as the pursuing army enters the towering walls of water, the sea swallows them up, horse, chariot, rider and all perish. And that is a great story. That's one of the best stories. That is one of the best stories in the history of stories ever. It just keeps getting better as you turn the pages. Israel moves out into the desert and starts their wandering, their 40 years of wandering. And in the 16th chapter of Exodus, the story tells us that on the 15th day of the second month since their escape, so Israel has been wandering now for 45 days, just a short 45 days ago, every single person wandering in the desert witnessed firsthand God coming down and saving them, saving their very own lives from the hand of the Egyptian army, not just by like a little dust cloud or something, but by parting a sea, an ocean. Every single person witnessed this, and then the sea unparts, right, and swallows up the enemy. But lo, as we humans are prone to do, it seems that just a mere 45 days later, these folks, who were both miraculously and spectacularly saved 45 days ago, these folks are grumpy. The story says that they are grumbling, or the story says that they are murmuring. Under their collective breath, they are complaining of hunger and saying, it was better to be a slave in Egypt than to be liberated to wander the desert. And you remember, this is where we get manna. This is where we get bread from heaven. And then that detail to remember about the manna. Do you remember? You can't gather it up and save it for tomorrow. It gets moldy overnight. So not only do we have bread from heaven, but we also have our daily bread. Give us this day our daily bread. We probably remember that too. That, of course, is not the end of the story, right? Because we've been hearing it for the last 4 weeks. So we fast forward to John chapter 6, and Jesus is with his disciples, a number of disciples, doing his bread of life thing. And it's not just bread that will satiate your hunger for a day, but it's bread that will satiate you for eternity. The disciples aren't really following him. They're struggling here. And then he comes in with this piece that we have from this Sunday with this, eat my flesh and drink my blood. And they're offended. They're offended and confused. And they begin to grumble. They begin to murmur. And then there's this beautiful but tense exchange, right? This teaching is difficult, they say. Who can accept it, they say. And Jesus responds, I'm paraphrasing Jesus here. Oh, are you offended now? Have I offended you? And I read this story in the summer of 2021 in the United States of America, and I'm like, yes, now this is a story that can inform my faith, how I live it out today, this very day. You see, there's Jesus over in one corner, and then there's this group of disciples over in another corner. And they're both pretty hot, right? They're pretty upset. The disciples are saying, Jesus, you're off the rails, bro. And Jesus is responding with this kind of sarcastic, like, Jesus, you're off the rails, bro. Like, really? Really I am? I don't think so. I don't think I am. To make a tense situation even more loaded, they're not arguing about where to go to dinner. They're not arguing about who left his tunic on the floor of the bathroom. They're not even arguing about climate change or immigration. This argument is top two hot button issues, right? Politics or religion. Those are the two. And this is religion, y'all. And we know religious arguments divide people, tear them apart, tear families apart, tear whole countries apart. We were watching that on the news for the last 10 days. Religious dispute fueling oppression and warfare, violence, emotional, physical, and cultural violence. This argument is one of the two granddaddies of them all. It is. And then we remember how this story ends, don't we? The seventh chapter of John is unfortunately the last chapter of that gospel. The disciples and all who support them cancel Jesus. Disgraced and angry, Jesus fades back into the culture, even more cynical and bitter than ever, vowing never to show up at that stinking synagogue ever again, or at least until those disciples are long gone, and he buys 5 acres in the suburbs and builds his own church. Wait. No. That's not it. That's not what happens here. That's not how the story goes. It's true that some of those disciples, not the 12, do leave. They found themselves too challenged by Jesus' leadership, outpaced by his expansive and mystical interpretation of God's relationship with God's creatures and creation. Some of them do, abandoned the movement. But that core, even in the face of confusion and disagreement, with that core, there is no broken relationship. They stick together. Even in the face of disagreement, they can see that there is something to this daily bread thing. There's something to being both miraculously and spectacularly saved, as well as being gently led to a more expansive understanding of what it means to be and who might be considered beloved of God. Church, it's almost as if some holy and spirited thing wrote this particular story for you and for me, for y'all and for us. Even in the face of confusion, even when confronted with conflict and disagreement, our very present work is sticking together in love. I love this exchange between Jesus and Peter at the end. Jesus says, "Well, y'all want to go too?" And Peter softens, right? How wise of him, how wonderful of him. He softens and responds, "And where would we go? To whom would we go?" Man, y'all, we are in this together. This, all of this, is about love. We are in this together. Those of you who are Democrats, and those of you who are Republicans, we are in this together. Those of you who wear masks, and those of you who don't, we are in this together. Those of you who are vaccinated, and those of you who are not, you two differing groups of people are in this together. Those of you who have skin the color of mine, and those of you who have skin the color of my daughters, and those of you who have every other shade of skin color, we are in this together. Documented or undocumented, rich or poor, male or female, or non-binary, we are in this together. Bishop, priest, deacon, dog catcher, or cat lover, we are in this together. Call it an altar. Call it a table. Call it whatever you want. Just please, please remember, we are in this together. We are the shelter of each other. We are God's beloved. And we have work to do together. Amen.